Our neighbor here in Chapel Hill, Elizabeth Spencer, is getting attention again all over the country. In the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times is reviewing her new book of stories called Starting Over. And we persuaded her to come talk with us about the challenges of writing and continuing to write. Elizabeth, I think 65 years or more after the publication of your first book, that you're still writing.
I'm still at it. It's a habit hard to break.
Is that right? Is that right? Or you're just saying that?
I'm just saying that because through the years, my work's furnished me a lot of joy, and I go back to it and find that other things I can write about, even at an advanced age. And so that's been a kind of joy to know that I can still do it. And furthermore, that it's not only publishable, but is welcome to a good many reviewers. And so that's been a great pleasure to get out a book so late in my life.
Well, also, it's a book of short stories. And short stories, people say, they're not the highest marketable things. But yours both sell and also gain attention.
Well, they have for the last two rounds of books. I haven't been able to finish a novel since my last collection was The Southern Woman, which you remember, and that's in Modern Library still. And it was an assortment of stories I've written through the years and published with some new stories mixed in. But I didn't realize I was going to keep going after that.
You thought that was going to be your capstone?
That would be my final effort. But on the other hand, I just found myself sitting down and writing sometime. And that's been a pleasure to see that it wasn't too bad what I did. But I did try to do a novel, and I could never finish it. So maybe someday I'll get back to it.
So it's in the drawer?
It's in the corner, decently covered.
Or maybe in the computer.
In the computer, sure, unless something wipes it out.
Not only great writers, but a lot of people say they have a novel in the drawer or that they worked on it and it didn't work out. They sent it to the publisher, it got sent back, and now they're discouraged about it. Then sometimes those things get picked up and made into publishable books.
Yes, that's true, but I never sent this out anywhere because it didn't satisfy me. If it never gelled, as it were, and it didn't satisfy me, I just felt I shouldn't inflict it on anybody else until I could work it up.
I want to talk about Starting Over, which is your new book. But before we do, talk some more about what it takes when you've got a novel that arguably is completed, but it's not satisfactorily completed. Do you just look at it and say, it's not only not good enough now, but I don't see how I can fix it?
I got tired of it, as a matter of fact. I'd started and tried to revise it and bring it about satisfactorily. I think there's some good scenes in it, and there's some valid characters, but it just never came together,
I don't know what that means, what comes together.
Well, came together in one single story. A novel is really telling you one single story, but it's a long story with many pieces in it that are coming together toward the central story. And so if it never does that, you can shake it or you can scold it or you can work on it. But if it doesn't happen, but there are a great many things that one starts and never finishes or are not satisfactory to you when you do. You wouldn't like to have something published that didn't satisfy you. And so I've always felt that I had a whole product to give to the market or to people to read.
No, I think that's interesting and real important. Those of us who have not been as successful like you, we would love to have anything published just to put in our library and say we published it. So you have written this novel that you don't believe should be published now, but you, when you started out, didn't you have an idea about what that story might be?
I worked on it, and I thought I saw light at the end of the tunnel, and I kept working. But it just never came together. To me, it may be two separate stories trying to combine but unable to, and I finally gave up on it.
I'm not going to dwell on it anymore, but I think it's comforting for people who are trying to write or learning to write or engaged in any kind of thing to know that there are pieces of work that a successful author has worked really hard on and believed in, and then just at the end of the line has to say, for me and the partnership that I have with my fans and my readers, I can't give it up. It's not good.
I don't think I ever got so far as telling the publisher about it or anybody else except you. I'm telling you now. But
we won't tell. I promise. We won't tell a soul about it. What was the name? What was going to be the name of the novel?
Oh dear, I changed it so often. Wait a minute, I'll try to think of it.
Well, let's do talk about Starting Over, which is your new book, and
yes,
which has just come out and has come out to, as we mentioned earlier, to some considerable, authoritative, favorable reviews. Do you just wait on edge for the reviews to come out now?
You try to say you're not nervous about what's coming from the New York Times or anywhere else, but then usually someone manages to get hold of the review before it's published, and therefore it's gratifying when it's favorable. You can quit shaking and worrying about it.
Well, do you get mad when somebody misinterprets or misunderstands and takes a little swipe at you?
Well, of course. Everybody has to experience, everybody who publishes at all has to experience these people who refuse to understand or don't have the, or maybe what you've written is not as good as it should be. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to leave yourself open to criticism.
Well, all right. Now, this is, if this is a dirty question, you can just say, I'm not going to answer. But one of the reviewers, I think this is in the Los Angeles Times, a very favorable review and quite a nice summary of each story and why it was good. And then he came to two stories.
Uh-huh.
He didn't have two good things to say. One was a little Christmas story that you wrote for Our State, and he said this was just too short to get anywhere. And then
I thought it was too, really, when I wrote it, but my editor liked it so much. But the New York Times has turned out praising it, so there we are.
So there you are in the middle of two pretty good
opposing
people. And two friendly reviewers.
Right,
who
right.
Now, the other one, the other story that the Los Angeles Times, if I got this wrong, you tell me, but as I remember, the Los Angeles Times reviewer thought that one of your stories that I loved because it was just multicultural all over the place. I loved it when we had the Carolina cheerleaders coming in and they were just of all colors and kinds and everything.
Yes.
And the reviewer said, there's just too much multicultural stuff in here.
Yeah, he thought I was pushing the point too much.
Now, did you agree with that?
It may have been true, except I enjoyed writing it because it seems to me, of course, I've named the town Eltonville and the university something else, but it's recognizably, though I'm not copying people, I'm inventing people, but the place is recognizably something like Chapel Hill. Okay.
Tell us that story. Tell us the outline of the story. What's the story about?
She's rather talented and has talked before, and she's just getting a divorce. And the husband is being rather truculent with her, the ex-husband, but she has to get a job. And she goes back to teaching, and she finds a fairly good job teaching at the university. And it's not what she'd like, but it's business writing. And she studies up on it and goes to work with new students trying to introduce them to good writing, whether it's a... It's just not all computerized writing. And so then in her class, there's a student from India, a very enigmatic sort of guy. And then the more she goes on in life there, the more different people of different racial characteristics show up. And throughout the story, she's meeting with people who are not Anglo-Saxon, white, Southern business
type.
The
new, like, the new South.
The new, like the new everything, I guess, but especially around a university town with people coming in all the time from different places.
I love that feature of the story, but what's the point? I mean, what was the story? What was this woman experiencing that transformed her, or was a transforming moment in her life, or changed her life?
Well, I think it's her discovery of the way... her daughter is dating a man from Mexico, and he has a story to give, and everybody has a story to give, but her ex-husband keeps, because they have a daughter, keeps hovering in the background and in a way trying to get her to come back to him.
The woman whose attraction took him away from his current wife, the lead character in your story, that relationship is broken up, and now the husband's hungry again to come back and have a relationship.
He's thinking
with her
that he might come back and have a relationship with his wife again, and so he's always intruding in the background, trying to get back in some way. And so I think the story really ends when she finally reaches the point of complete rejection, as you know, in the end, when he blows up at her, because I don't like to tell the complete point of the story. But then the Indian man, who's something of a fortune teller.
A fortune teller? A fortune hunter or a fortune teller?
He's sort of like he has the gift of penetrating what her thoughts may be about something.
Oh, okay.
In that sense, he sees into the whole thing. And at the end, he tells her she's finally succeeded. Don't you remember that? Maybe that's the end of it to me, because there was still threads of the feelings before the divorce hanging on that finally led to the husband dismissing the ex-husband and moving on. That's what it meant to say, maybe.
That she moves on.
Yeah.
He goes through this, what would be a transformative experience. She's as a teacher to college, but not unlike what we would expect when an 18-year-old goes to college and is mixed in with a whole different environment. And when you leave, you're a different person. So she, through the teaching and contact with all of these kids and all of this stuff happening, when it's all over in your story, she's different.
I think so.
Where'd you get this story?
I don't know. I just kept following it. Sometimes a story will just tell itself to you rather than you telling it. I just was trying to follow her through the various shifts and turns. But I was a little nervous about depicting an Indian character. But my husband and I, when we lived in Montreal, in Canada, we knew a lot of Indians, and the rhythm of their speech was something that an English friend of my husband's used to mimic all the time.
Oh, really?
He got the rhythm of it.
He was
perfectly
British, and so
it sounded like he would mimic. But anyway, I was a little hesitant in writing a dialogue like an Indian person might speak. So somebody at UNC had an Indian student in his class and said, you can meet her if you want to. So I did, and I gave her a copy of the story because her parents had just recently immigrated to the States from India, from a small city in India. So she took the manuscript home with all the dialogue in it.
My golly.
And they sent it back saying that it was very well done. So I quit worrying after that, because at least it met their ear as being successful. And so that...
Well, the other challenge that an author or anyone who writes about or talks about any particular part of our current multicultural heritage, whether you talk about African-Americans or Indians or Chinese or Mexicans or other Latin American people, you run the risk of unintentionally being offensive to some part of that group. Now, as far as Indians are concerned, it's more delicate. They seem to be more – here now I'm generalizing and I'm going to get into trouble. But like at the recent exhibit at the Acklen of modern Indian provocative political art.
Yes.
In the effort to have – We found out that there were a lot of people in the Indian communities here in the Triangle. Many of these people involved in the .com world are from India. They're here. I'm generalizing, but you have to worry if you say something that would be offensive.
Yeah, you do. Well, were they resentful of the exhibit? No,
not that I know of. I think it was that there was.
A great many, Indian, you mean.
Right, but there was an overwhelming interest in the exhibit. This was something that was no more interesting to them than other exhibits.
Art
that, and that what the exhibit about Indian art is aimed at us, at you and me. We need to learn about that kind of art. All right, I'm going to leave this story, but you mentioned that there was a Mexican This is a little subplot within your short story.
Yes, right.
Of Carlos yeah. and his parents. And you talk about, I mean, these guys, this family came in with the beneficiaries. They were friends of the people who owned the factory or something. And then they went on, you know, went out.
Well, that's a little subplot.
Yeah, tell about that. You can tell about that. Well,
as I remember, I haven't read this in a while, but the father of this young Mexican that the girl is dating was employed by this American factory. And then in Mexico... And then he thought the work people weren't being treated right, so he raised a kind of a group organized against the factory, and that's what got them kicked out, wasn't it? I've forgotten.
Yeah, well, it was the whole...
And the mother is still there. She's a big, buxom Mexican woman who keeps greeting the girl in the story. That's her son and... This woman's daughter would make good babies, so they were already already sleeping together or something, and this upset the woman that's in the story.
Well, this is so different from what it was like in our region growing up.
Uh-huh.
And you wrote stories about, you know, that challenged our attitudes and the way we handled race, but now it's so much more complicated. And are you excited about that? Does that make life more interesting for you that it's not just black and white, but that it's black and white and red and yellow and everything else?
Oh, you mean, well, I was brought up in small town Mississippi where things, it indeed were complicated, but the issues were mainly, the way I wrote about them, were really sometimes racial. And that wasn't as complicated as any number of strange nationalities coming in. I don't think there was anybody in any of my earlier fiction that was not from the South or, you know,
well, I've gotten off on a tangent. Elizabeth Spencer, we're talking about your new book, Starting Over.
Yes.
And maybe this was a good story to start with. I don't think we ever told anybody the name of this one. It was Rising Tide, and it's a good story.
Yes, Rising Tide.
To start with. One of my favorites. Elizabeth Spencer, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with our neighbor, Elizabeth Spencer, whose new book, Starting Over, has just come out and is gaining national attention. And Elizabeth, you've been good enough. I just wanted to talk about one of these stories. And let's talk about the other story that this Los Angeles Times reviewer thought was too short and too compact to get across a point. This is the story. I wish we were at Christmas time. We could be talking about it. This is a story about it. And this story was written for Our State magazine a year ago. And you have this this woman, 40 or 50 years afterwards, sitting up in New England, remembering her childhood Christmas pageant, and how she wanted to be an angel so bad in the play. Well, then what happened?
Couldn't be an angel.
Why?
Well, no, that story more than anything else was based on experience from Mississippi. I remember being brought up a Presbyterian. We always had a Christmas pageant. And I remember once I wanted to be an angel, and everybody said I could. And so I got to the church and found that I had grown too tall for the angel group. I had to be a shepherd. And this meant not a white dress with a lot of tinsel in my hair and wings and all, but sort of a gray bathrobe.
and
a shepherd's crook.
Yeah, a shepherd's crook.
I was so disappointed. And so transferring that feeling and all the doings about the pageant to a town in North Carolina that's near the mountains was pretty easy. I just had to plunk it down somewhere where you could see mountains in a distance. And that accomplished the... But I guess if it were a longer story, the seams would have shown that it couldn't possibly be North Carolina. But it seemed to get by with our state all right. And so I had written it in a hurry and just through memory more than anything else. But I don't have a sister like this girl did, and she wanted something else. She wanted snow. I remember crying for snow when I was in Mississippi, too, and we seldom got snow. Sometime we did because it came down that central basin of the Mississippi River. It would come pushing right on through. I expect that may have done that now.
Yeah.
But snow is not part of this cold wave, apparently, but at any rate, we finally would get snow sometimes. So I put the two longings together and gave them
made
to
them two different little girls. But both of these girls are you.
No, I didn't mean that. Neither one of them is me.
But sort of.
I get the longings for both of them, and they quarrel a lot, so it couldn't be me quarreling with me.
Well, this is a great, you know, it's got great parts to the story, and one of them is that as far as the snow, the little girl who wanted the snow, she got her snow because her uncle and her daddy drove up to the mountains and got real snow and brought it back and made snow cream.
Yeah, snow cream. Also, I had
that memory. Never happened, right?
No, I had memories of snow cream because that's what we used to do. Did you ever have snow cream?
I think we just poured some cream over the snow and put some sugar or something like that, and
a little vanilla flavoring over this packed snow makes a wonderful little dish. And we used to eat it pleasantly when we actually had snow in Mississippi.
Well, here's the other part. Now, help me with this. The other part is in the memory. This woman, she's telling the story to her husband. And what happened, if I'm giving the story away, you just have to forgive me. Because it's worth reading a lot of times. What after they brought down this snow from the mountains for these little girls and made the snow cream, they went outside and it was snowing.
It was snowing.
And so the woman, I'm just saying your husband, but you're the narrator, the main character's husband, after hearing this story, said, baloney. Said, all right for your parents to spoil you and do these things, but for God to be brought
give
in.
Give you snow.
To give you snow. That I don't believe. And you kind of close out the story.
Yeah.
Now, that's a great story. Why would anybody...
Well, they were all being spoiled. I suppose I was spoiled, too. And I thought about an uncle of mine and my father. This never happened. I made it up. If you're dealing with something that's factual, you're going to find you make up a great deal that somehow flows into the main pattern. So that's what I invented. But I remember being very spoiled when I was young, and anything that I wanted, people would try to get it for me, except they couldn't make me an angel. But the mother in the story made little wings and
made them out
pencil.
Of, how did she make her wings?
Coat hangers.
How did you know about that?
I just thought it up. I remember some of these kids that they made into angels, they did use bent coat hangers and bound them in cheesecloth and tinsel to make wings.
In the Smithville Presbyterian Church Christmas pageant.
I got an angry letter from some... Well, at home, it was like this. The Baptists were the most popular, enormous congregation. The Methodists were next. The Presbyterians smaller. And the Presbyterian pageant that my mother used to direct was the main one at Christmas, and I do remember that. But the Episcopalians were a very small group, and there was only one Catholic in the whole town. But when the little girl says the Catholics were fewer and they didn't even call it church, this woman wrote me and said I was very disrespectful to Catholics. And I wasn't meaning that at all. So I answered her and told her I had every respect for the Roman Church, but after all, they don't call it church. They call it Mass, and so... I was just being factual, I thought.
Well,
I didn't
great.
Mean to insult anybody.
Well, the feature of the story that grabbed me, that one of the features was that as a writer, these people were not you, but inspired by things that were important in your life, and that if you didn't like the way it really happened, you got the power to rewrite it the way you would have sort of wanted it to happen.
Right, to make a story of it, sure.
And that's a great Christmas. That's a great Christmas present.
You liked it. You liked the story. You thought it was enough. Well, it was a very short story. Others in the book are much longer.
Let me say, I'm going to take a break. But the other thing about this story that's different from your other stories is that you wrote it quickly. You know, usually, I'm putting words in your mouth, so you correct me if I'm wrong, but you usually like to stir around your words and check things and let it sit for a while and come back to it. Not this story.
No, I wrote it very fast one afternoon. But other things come very rapidly. Not all stories are rewritten and pondered over, but they just seem to flow sometimes.
Yeah. You said once that this story that haunts us, that we love, this light, The Light in the Piazza, that came out pretty quickly.
Yeah, it was a fast-written story. I spent only, I think, about a week writing that story, and it turned out to be longer than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a story of about 20 pages. It turned out to be nearly 100, and even then, when it was published as a novel, I stuck some bits in that I'd cut out for the New Yorker magazine where it was published first. So it was really a novella length. And there's one story in this book called The Wedding Visitor that I wrote.
Can we take a break?
Sure.
And then we'll come back and talk. I do want to talk about The Wedding Visitor, evocative sort of Light in the Piazza. I'm visiting with Elizabeth Spencer, and you guys who are listening, just please excuse me. I'm so excited about the chance to talk to her that maybe I'm talking a little too much. We'll let her talk more.
That's all right.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Elizabeth Spencer, a famed Chapel Hill writer, and I think the most recent book of our Chapel Hill writers has come out. It's called Starting Over. It's got great reviews, and we think it's going to be a sales success as well. And so, Elizabeth, you've been generous in talking about some of these stories. I don't think we've given them. I think we've just whetted people's appetite for them.
Well, I had to reread them and find out little points that you might break up, bring up that I wouldn't know really what to say. But anyway, you have to. I had to remember what I was, what it was like when I wrote them, and what twists and turns they gave me that I hadn't anticipated.
One of the stories, I guess it's the last story in the book, is called The Wedding Visitor.
That's a very recent story. I didn't write that very long ago, I think.
This, though, is that, you know, you grew up in Mississippi, so many of your, much of your work is set there.
Oh, that's set in Mississippi.
Yeah.
That's true. I'd forgotten that.
But this, you've written in North Carolina and then looking back to the home territory for the geography of the place. About what time? Is this like in the 50s or 70s?
Well, I tried to capture that very question in the first. He walks in the house and finds his cousin Emily reading a magazine that has Ronald Reagan on the cover, and then she says, "Are you going to vote for Reagan?" and something like that.
So
then that taps it into time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it'll be.
So it's in the 70s or early
80s.
Yeah,
it'll be just the time when he's probably running for his second term or something like that. So that's how I right away nailed it into time. So none of the things like they don't have, for instance, cell phones. He has to go and make a call, you remember?
Yeah.
And things like that.
There's a wedding, a family wedding happening, and your main character, Rob Ellis, is coming sort of back to his cousin's, his old family house. Maybe he didn't grow up there, but his cousins grew up there.
He was a summer guest, say a lot. That house is... That was the house I was brought up in. Now, the people are all made up. There's nobody in it that's not invention. But using that house gave me the feeling of security in moving around in it.
You knew the geography of the house.
Exactly.
Well, tell us that. Tell us a little bit about the story. Tell us about Rob, and then tell us a little bit about what he walks into.
His father, unusual in those times, at least in my family, was a divorced man who got his son in the summers and didn't know what to do with him. And so he farmed him out at his brother's house, you know, and that's where he was every summer. And since he wasn't actually one of the immediate family, they made fun of him a lot, and he felt bad about that, but he got on. He went and was a lawyer, and then he was living away, I believe, in Memphis. But then when he got a wedding invitation, he decided after so long a time to go back and see how they all were. And so he's the wedding visitor.
So who's getting married?
Well, his cousin. Oh, wait a minute now. You're catching me. What was her name? Emily, but the other one.
Normie.
Normie's getting married. And he'd grown up in the summers with Normie. And
she's a strange girl.
Well, she's... You know,
or maybe
she's
normal
a little
girl.
Bit wild. She's a little bit wild, like a lot of Mississippi girls. But anyway, she's met this this man that with the road crew there that she wants to marry, and they're about to get married. But she didn't want to wear the wedding dress they'd picked out for her and made for her. And
you've told us this is maybe around early 80s, and she's standing up. She wants more. She's not going to wear that white dress.
Sorry. No, she thought it was dishonest for her to wear that white dress. She'd been engaged a couple of times before. She thought it was a false representation. She wanted to wear a dress that would be like what she was, her honest self. So she's just rebelling against what the family wants her to do. And that's what he walks in on.
Well, Rob is a lawyer. He's sort of a fixer.
He's gotten in the position of fixer for the congressman he's working for, who's now running also for re-election. What's his name? Stockton. And keeps calling him from Memphis to ask him about what to do about this, what to do about that. So, yeah, he's a fixer in the national scene. But now he becomes, unbeknownst to him or unpredictable, he becomes a fixer in the home he's visiting.
I don't think we're giving away anything, but the husband, I mean, the fiance, the prospective husband of Normie has gotten himself into a little bit of jam, right? So that, this whole thing, it happens sometimes where you find out sort of at the last minute that the person, your cousin or your daughter or your sister or brother is marrying, has a checkered past or has a problem that's going to
embarrass him. He has a problem in the present. I don't know how bad a checkered past it was. He's in charge of the day-to-day finances of this road crew that's there building a highway. And the highway is bypassing the town, but near enough so that most of them working on the highway are lodging in the town. And so in order to swell his bank account... I shouldn't give this away because the story's going to be ruined.
Go ahead.
He just borrowed from the account to clothe himself for the wedding and partly pay for his honeymoon. And this hadn't come to light at all until, how did it come to light? I've forgotten. They found when they went to the bank check against that account that it was missing, and the reason it was missing because he had taken it. So the father of the bride-to-be, who is Rob's cousin, has heard about it, and he's a stern, upright, staunch Presbyterian man, and he's going to stop the whole wedding because of that.
Now, so this we won't tell the rest.
This is a jam.
This is great. All right, now I would say we'll stop talking about it.
Yeah.
It gets to be complicated.
Yeah.
And it gets everybody identifies with different people, but I'm identifying with Rob all over the place in terms walking into a situation and being expected to be there. And then you got to... do something. Anyway, we won't give any more. And we'll stop. We need to take a break. We'll come back and talk about another one of the great stories in Elizabeth Spencer's new book, Starting Over. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Elizabeth Spencer, who has a brand new book out of short stories called Starting Over. We've been talking, Elizabeth. It's been fun to talk about some of these stories. One of the stories that I can't say I didn't enjoy the story. I did enjoy kind of looking back, but it hadn't stayed in my memory. The New York Times reviewer points out your story on the Hill as maybe the best of the lot.
Well, he liked it the best.
What's it about?
Well, this is a wholly invented story. I don't know what started me on it except the terrain around here. Again, it's Eltonville, which you can easily see maybe the surroundings.
All right, I'm going to interrupt you. It's one of these rich people who moves in out in the country and builds a house, and nobody really knows who they are, but they come in and they quote, take the place by storm because they're so attractive.
Well, they're attractive and they give elegant parties. And so the people that they meet and invite to these are really very favorable to them because everything is so glittering and fine and beautifully done. And
we know about it. We know these people. And you've set this in Chapel Hill or Eltonville.
Oh, Eltonville. And so a lot of people are enchanted with them because they seem to be very well healed. And he's in some mysterious job of cancer, new cancer research at the hospital. And so, of course, that's not understandable to people who aren't in medicine, but at the same time, it's very acceptable. And so there he is and his attractive wife and his little boy. And so it develops that the people who are invited think they're just wonderful, but can't find out very much about them. And so where are they from? Well, they'll tell you. They'll tell you everything. They'll give you the factual answer to everything, but it still doesn't quite make sense. And so it goes on like that. And then I think the story is concerned with how the glittering facade begins to crumble. And what the story is really about is the woman who's telling the story is a neighbor who's very impressed with all that. And she has a nice husband who's not so impressed with all that. And he keeps putting the brakes on her, thinking so highly of these people. And, you know, he's a sort of truculent character, but sympathetic, I think. I liked him, and I liked her. I liked all of them, as a matter of fact.
You did. You like even these strange people. You liked them.
Well, like
them. Because they give good—you wanted to go to their party?
Oh, I might have been there. But anyway, the little boy is the one that it begins
to focus. Tell us about the little boy.
Well, the little boy, for some reason, is a very disturbed child. And instead of going home from the school bus, which stops halfway between the woman who's telling the story, her house, and his own home. And so he walks one day to her house, and she can tell he's disturbed. She tries to take him home, and something strange happens when she takes him. And so she herself is trying to have a child. She's had one miscarriage, and you can tell she's longing for her own child. And so this unfolds as a relationship between this woman and the child of the glitter people. And then it begins, that glitter begins to crumble, and the child himself is, she thinks, being wounded. And so that also evolves into a strange story of a very strange church they belong to, and a scene visiting, and nobody can figure out what's going on in this church. It seems to be a very bizarre kind of worship, and that's part of the...
I didn't remember anything in Chapel Hill or Eltonville.
Oh, no, I don't either. I don't either, but just the same one sees sometimes churches and hills of churches that have very weird practices.
Right.
That's all I meant.
Well, the one of the reviewers mentioned with respect to this story that it reflected your one of the stories that reflected your concern about how adults, or particularly women, deal with other people's children that they become somehow either deliberately or accidentally responsible for.
Well, this because the child appeals to her. I mean, himself, he's appealing for somebody to understand and help. And so she's the one selected once. He comes to her again, I think twice again. Once she takes him to buy an ice cream cone, you know, and other things happen between them that attaches her. In the meantime, she gets pregnant herself. And so the story ends when she's having her own child. And so I think it has a cumulative effect.
Can you, Elizabeth?
But it doesn't relate to anybody. And unlike some of the other stories I've told you.
This is all made up.
This is just an invention drawn on the terrain around the Piedmont, where you sometimes go up a road and you don't know what you're going to find. And maybe a beautiful house or maybe a shack. You don't know. So the surroundings here are very interesting to me.
Well, thanks for coming and sharing them. I love talking about some of the stories in your new book, Starting Over, amazing collection of stories that you've shared with us, and you inspire us by your continued
Oh, thank you for having me. Don't tell me we're concluding.
Well, I'm sorry. We'll come back and talk some more.
That would be fun.
Congratulations.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks to Elizabeth Spencer for her book, Starting Over, and also to you for listening. This has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. I'll be back here before you know it.